and I used to say that was luck. And it's not until I was interviewed the other week, and then I thought, it ain't actual luck. Actually, I've created this. You know, that's not being appreciative of myself. Whereas before, I told you I've changed. So before, I would have just shoved that off as luck. But now I actually understand that's not luck. I've created that world around me. Hey everyone, and welcome to the Stay Hungry podcast. Today, our special guest is hospitality business coach and restaurateur Callum Richardson, multiple award-winning, ex-forces, and definitely one of life's good guys. Let's go. Mr. Richardson, how the devil are you?
I'm good, and devil's probably the right word.
Right, okay, yes, you're in for a treat today, guys. Yes, put the kids away. We always start with the three W's here. Mm-hmm. So would you like to explain to people who may not be familiar with all the good work that you do, what you do, mm-hmm. who for, and why?
Okay, so I am Carl Knudsen. I have the Bay Fish and Chips in Stonehaven. Sustainability is big key factor of me. I also have Forked Up Coaching, which is for the hospitality industry, so I can coach people, get them out of bad habits and get them moving forward. Also, I supply Compass Group, which is feeds the forces, feeds the hospitality industry. I supply them with batter mix and fish cakes.
So. Blimey, right, okay. And why do you do what you do? Sort of what gets you up in the morning? Apart from your dogs.
The dogs.
So obviously you drove down to Shropshire last night, walking the dogs at some silly o'clock this morning like me.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So, you know, what gets me going is I like to make folks smile. You know, really, and I think that's what food does. It makes people smile.
Chippy tea certainly does.
Yeah, but it's my personality. I like to make folk happy. I'm a people pleaser, to be honest.
Do you still love being front of house in the chippy then? Or are you trying to move away from that?
I don't really operate much in there.
Okay.
It's more self-run now.
Okay.
But I was in there this week, and that was the first time in a while.
So how was it sort of pulling back from front of house then? Because imagine with your personality, you must have got to the point where a lot of customers were like, oh, is Callum not in today? And sort of moving away from that. Has that been okay? Or people buying into the team now?
I think the crucial thing in the whole of that is you need consistency.
Right.
So you need consistency. I think in any way of life, especially if it's hospitality, you don't want folk to walk past the door and say, I'm not going in tonight, it's not Callum working. It shouldn't be that. You know, it should be just the same non-stop. So I control, there's only a few people cook in the business, because then we can keep the consistency instead of letting any idiot get in front of the pan and cooking. So the hardest thing for stepping away was myself, was the hardest thing. And I actually...
Well, letting go, you mean?
Yeah, letting go. And this would have been early on. I learned this lesson early on, but I didn't learn it properly early on. The seed was planted.
Right.
And it's like anything, you know, you look back and there's always something early on you don't really take it on board. And what happened was I'd entered Young Fish Fryer of the Year in my first business I owned. It was a Karen Fish Bar. And what happened was I was in the final six of Young Fryer of the Year for the UK. And I thought, what can I do to be different from the other five? And I seen an advert in the paper. That's right, there was adverts in papers back in the day. And there was an advert in the paper for this thing called Shell Live Wire Business Growth Challenge for under 30s. And I was 29, and I thought, right, let's see what this is all about. So I thought, I'll go and do this course. Signed up, went away to the west of Scotland for 3 days.
Right.
And it wasn't a course, it was a competition. Now, I didn't know this. And it was run by ex-forces, possibly special forces, I'm unsure. Nowadays, I would have probably asked, but these guys were high up in the forces anyway, right. In the army or the marines. And they basically said, everyone got together, and then they put some apparatus on the floor and says, okay, you don't know what this is, build it. I thought, I do, that's a fucking camp bed. That's a bit of kit for shaving. So I'm there, chink, 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 blimey, building all this stuff. And then they said it was a competition. So they grouped us, and it was a lot of get from A to B with a rope and a barrel and all this kind of nonsense. And that was right up my street, team playing. Mm-hmm. So I was there having a laugh, enjoying it. It was kind of going back to the Navy for me. And then they made us do this test at the end. It's a famous test. I can't remember what it's called. But you basically have to read it and answer the multiple choice instantly. None of this having a think.
Right.
Do it right away. So it would be something like, if a member of staff comes to you with an idea, do you, one,
okay,
accept it, bin it, think about it, you know. So I'm going, chunk, chunk, chunk. Came back the day later and they said, right, you've won. I said, I've won. Won what? So they come back and compete against all the other winners from the UK for the year.
Right, okay.
But they gave me feedback from this test. And the feedback was, I need to step back from the vehicle. I can't progress in life if I don't let go, because there's no room for growth if you're tying yourself to the beast.
Wow.
And I was like, that is me. And I knew it was. And I thought when I was driving home from the West Coast, how hard it was for me to have that couple of days off to do that course. And I thought, shit, it's right. And then it wasn't until the year before I won Fish and Chip Shop of the Year in my next business, so we're talking maybe 5 years later, and we didn't win, we got to final, and it was the best learning curve I had. But if I'd won then, I couldn't have done the things I've done because I'd have been tied to the vehicle. That was when the seed dropped and I thought, step back.
See, I know business owners, well, I'm sure you do as well, who've never been able to let go. They just can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
It just causes too much stress, too much anxiety. But some people, they're just not in the habit of letting go, and they micromanage, and it must be hard to work in that situation. Like you say, sometimes you need to get out of your own way.
You have to, because, you know, I know for a fact, for my old manager, it was in his shop, I could have made more money, especially back in the day, not so much nearer the end, but back in the day, I could have made more money than him when I was in the shop. And maybe even now, if I was in and people knew I was there, it maybe would encourage it. Not to say I'm better, but I think I could draw more money. And the place would be tidier, okay? And this used to be what was in my head. It's the old Navy mentality. The place had to be capped in round standards all the time. But then you look back and you think, how much money have we made today? That's a fucking lot of money. Is the shop tidy? Everyone always goes on, the shop's immaculate, the customers.
Mm.
That's what matters. And I'm thinking, so really, shut your hole.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The problem's me. It's not anything else. You know, okay, I could get down and cause more mayhem,
mm-hmm.
but what would that gain? Nothing. Probably lose staff.
Yeah, so, well, I mean, you mentioned the Navy there. So, I mean, obviously, your coaching business is forked up.
Uh-huh.
You've got the Bay. You've been in the food industry for a long time, but it was the forces first. So what made you sign up to the Navy, and, like, how old were you? Was that, like, 16 or something, mad?
I signed up at 15. I went in at
15?
Yeah, shit. Yeah. It was my goal. I knew that was the direction I wanted.
So did your GCSEs and that was it?
Well, I don't know if I'd done the GCSEs. I fucking turned up. so for me, it was always going to be the Navy. My dad was Merchant Navy.
Okay.
But that's not where it came from. Like, I've had no pressure from family at all like that. Was in a Sea Cadets. I loved it. I'm a hands-on guy. I'm not academic. I'm dyslexic. I hated school, big time. And when I was in primary school, my mum took me away to London to get tested for dyslexia because no one believed it.
Oh, okay.
Like, and back then, you know what I mean?
So this is what, like the 80s or something?
Yeah, that would have been, it would probably be 1980.
Right, okay.
81 maybe. So she took me to London and they said, dyslexic. I had a high IQ, which is common with dyslexia. And it was a good turning point actually for me, because remember Susan Hampshire was there, Duncan Goodhue.
Oh, wow, shit.
So Duncan Goodhue was the swimmer.
Swimmer, yeah.
And Susan Hampshire, she was an author. And she was like pretty much saying, I've written these books, so you can do anything. Mm. And I'm thinking, fucking hell. You know,
that's amazing, because back then, I mean, there must have been quite a few kids who had dyslexia, but it just wasn't diagnosed.
No, you were thick. You were just
thick. Yeah.
And we've got the opposite now. We've got folk that are thick as mints and they're just now dyslexic. Everyone's got a little label, but thick as mints doesn't seem to be a label anymore. So I remember I was in this place in London anyway, but there was the highlighted to you, I think Margaret Thatcher was dyslexic and she was Prime Minister at the time. You know, there was so many high rolling business people or people that would have been celebrity status, you would say. And it made you think, okay, fair enough. But then I went to secondary school and my mum kicked a stink and said, look, we've got certificates to prove it.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to do something. So they offered me for exams, I could have extra, I think 15 minutes for every hour. I could have a computer or I could have a scribe. And I was like, I'm having a scribe. That sounds like I don't have to do any fucking work. And then the best thing was, the scribes The scribes in my standard grades were folk in my sister's year at school, right? And I was doing, I think it was physics, and that was probably one of my strongest subjects.
Oh God, physics, right?
Right. I was doing physics, and I'm going A, and they're just like holding the pencil over B. I'm going B, B, it's B. Right. I failed the exam. Right?
Oh shit! Right.
But
okay.
I couldn't complain because if I complained, right. Honestly, I wouldn't have passed it anyway. I mean, I'm just only kidding myself.
So the Navy wasn't, so acceptance into the Navy, dyslexia didn't have anything to do with it, and you weren't dependent on your grades?
Well, yeah, no. So basically, I had to stay till fifth year Christmas because I was 16 in January.
Right.
So I couldn't leave in fourth year. So actually, I hated school. I fucking detested it. And it wasn't until fifth year I actually enjoyed it. Because in fifth year, I chose the subjects I wanted.
Hmm.
I didn't choose all the things. Like my mum and dad, I suppose, in a way, would have said, you've got to have physics and chemistry. Hmm. And, you know, there wasn't any pressure to do it. But back then at school, you had to pick subjects, and yeah. That was it. Fifth year, I took home economics, so cooking, because that's what I liked. But I wouldn't have picked that before, because that would have been gay. You know what I mean? And,
right, okay.
And back in them days, blokes didn't do the cooking exams and stuff. So I thought, right, stay out of that.
So which, you didn't do home ec?
Not until fifth year.
Oh, okay.
So I'd done it
okay.
as like first and second, but when I went to third and fourth year, I didn't do it.
But so you had an interest in food at an early age then?
Oh, I wanted to be a chef.
Right.
I wanted to be a chef in the Navy. That was my...
okay.
This was my plan.
Okay.
So I took home ec, I took metalwork, woodwork, technical drawing, I took all the hands-on stuff. I loved it. But I was pursuing a career in the Navy, so I went to careers office. But... they said, right, you need to do the exams because you don't have the standard grades. So I've got to do the exams. So I had to sit their English exam, their maths exam, and then a science exam.
Right.
So sat that and I passed. And then they said, okay, you're going in as an engineer.
Okay.
I'm like...
so you don't get any choice out what
well,
can I have these...
I did choose what I wanted.
Right.
But it wasn't until later in my life I realised how this worked.
Right. Okay.
I worked in the careers office for a while, but we'll get to that in a minute. So they basically said, right, you're going in as an engineer, you're happy with that. But it was a Navy I wanted to do. So really, you know, I wanted to be a photographer as well. That was another thing that I wanted to do. I like the idea of it. I've got, and I like taking photos, but I'm not artistic at all. And I couldn't join as a photographer. You've got to be in the Navy and then transfer
right,
over.
Right, okay.
So I thought, okay, well, we'll just go in as an engineer. So that was it. Passed. Dad was all great. Mum was like, happy for me, but I'm not sure. You're only 15, you know. I got a phone call on my 16th birthday, January 9th, and they said, why are you not at school? I said, oh, I'm doing my prelims, doing my study leave. Okay, we've got a date for you. Okay, when is it? 3 weeks' time.
Shit.
Yeah. I was like, fuck, I'm having that. Okay, I'm taking it. Because at that time, if you didn't take then, you would be waiting probably 6 months because there was so many folk getting intake.
Right.
So I went straight to school and left instantly. Went in and left. And the home economics teacher said to me, you've got the highest mark in the class.
Oh, wow.
And she said, I'm surprised. It's a shame you're leaving. And I thought, I've never heard a teacher say that to me before. I thought they normally fucking be holding the door open for me and shutting it behind me, like, you know.
So did you think at that point, that, you know, you didn't know how long your engineering career in the Navy would be.
Uh-huh.
Did you ever think you'd come back to food, or you wouldn't look that far ahead anyway?
Didn't look that far ahead. Because you sign up for 22 years in the Navy, but it's an open engagement, so you do 4 years, and then it's a year and a half's notice.
So it's 4 years minimum?
Yeah, so I think you do 2.5, and back in the day, 2.5 and then a year and a half's notice, so
okay.
4 years
okay.
would have to be the minimum you would do.
So how long did you do?
So I ended up doing just shy of 10 years.
Shit, right, okay.
But, so you said about, did I think I'd come back to chefing? No, but it became apparent when I was in the Navy. Spent half the time in the galley, especially on my last ship. Because I was on a small ship, there was only 30 of us on board. Two engineers.
30?
Yeah, two engineers, two chefs. And the chef, who was one of my best mates, he wanted to be an engineer. So he said to me... anytime you want to start an engine, phone me and I'll run up and I'll start the engine for you. And then I used to sneak down and cook breakfast while he was still sleeping and then wake him up and pretend he'd slept in and then say, fucking hell, Arnie, come on, get up. You slept in, you bastard. And then they would, but I'd already cooked everyone's breakfast. So that was kind of stepping stone for me.
Right.
It was like, I always said, it ain't a married man's life being in the forces, you know,
right,
especially the Navy. You're away 6 months.
6 months at a time.
Yeah, you go to the Gulf and stuff, and it was like.
So was this first Gulf War time, was it?
Yeah, so I was there as it kicked off.
Early '90s.
Yeah, 1990, 1991. I sailed to there on my 17th birthday.
Oh wow!
So that would have been 1990, yeah.
Right. Okay.
So, yeah, lost track. What did you say to me?
No idea. Yeah, no. Talk about. So you were doing breakfast. Interest in food carried
yeah,
on.
Yeah. So that was kind of the interest. I said it wasn't a married man's life. That's where we were at. So, because you're going away for long times, and I seen the married guys on board, and back then there wasn't mobile phones. You know, they were going and phoning home on a phone card machine on board, and you got alongside, and there was a big queue for it, and then they wouldn't come ashore because they had to put money home. You know, so, they had house, they had kids, they had a life outside the ship.
So after 6 months away, how long would you get at home before you went out again?
It varied. I remember 1 year we'd done 6 months deployment, came back, we had 2 weeks leave, port had 2 weeks, starboard had 2 weeks leave, and then we'd done a little bit of maintenance in that time. We were probably away within 2 months for another 6 months.
Shit. Right, okay. You know? Okay.
So one married man's life. So I just always said if I was getting married, I think I'd come out. Because the guys that were married, they couldn't just go and be Harley Racket and do what they wanted and mm-hmm. be Jack the Lad Sailor. Mm-hmm. So I was due to get married, so I put my notice in to leave.
Wow, right, okay.
It was really a hard decision because I still love the Navy, but I'm glad I left when I did now. But it was quite it was a real difficult transition. But I should have probably stayed in the Navy because I'm on my third wife. So
right, okay. So before we get onto that, so Callum, who joined the Navy,
yep.
Callum, who left the Navy, mm. what were those two kind of people? Were they fundamentally the same?
No, way different. A lot of folk might turn around and say the same. Sense of humour-wise, same. Still up to mischief, same. But as a boss, way different. And actually, as a person now, I've changed a lot in the past few years, to be honest. Okay. The past 6 years, there's been a big transition in me. So Callum joining the Navy, spotty, skin, as they call it in the Navy, because you just are skin in essence. And I was just 16, you know.
That's like my daughter's age. I was a tiny boy.
You know, there was guys, I remember turning up, and there was guys that were on their third career. It was almost like last ditch, you know.
Wow.
Whereas for me, this was the start. Mm. But I was brought up to cook at home, iron at home. Better not tell Victoria that I know how to do these things, by the way. And then, but I had all these skills. So I had personal skills where these 28-year-olds that were joining and on their third career couldn't wash their clothes, couldn't look after themselves. So actually, it was great. It meant I could focus on the new things I was learning in the Navy, but I didn't have to worry about my own personal appearance and stuff. I had that boxed off. So going into the Navy, I was skin, young, naive, yeah, but I was up for it anyway, you know, and I was looking at this as a long-term career. Came out of the Navy,
mid-20s.
That's really, really difficult, you know, like, I know you've podcasted Ollie. All these guys will tell you the same, and it's a bit different for them because of the job they had. But the transition from Forces to Civvy Street is so difficult.
So when you left, I suppose you didn't have the next step planned, did you? Or did you know what you wanted to do?
So my first wife's family had a fish and chip shop.
Okay.
And the original plan was, I was helping them out in that, and the original plan was that I was going to take over the lease of that. But that went wrong, because the landlord didn't want to renew it, so we ended up buying a building, an old building society, three floors, and creating a two-floored restaurant.
So when you say we, this is you and your wife, and her family?
Ex-wife and her family.
Right, okay.
So we created this restaurant, and it was difficult because my ex-wife was pregnant at the time.
Right, okay.
So she was out of the business. My ex-father-in-law had heart problems, so he was out of the business. So I was on my own, but it was good because I learned quickly that
right,
way.
Okay.
You know, you really had to get on with it. And it made me hungry.
So what a couple of the biggest lessons you learned at this period that have served you in good stead?
I think you have to believe in yourself. I think my Navy training was pretty good at, I knew the teamwork was important, to be, get the team on board you, get them working with you, not for you.
So there were employees reporting to you at that
point? Oh, yeah, 100%, yeah. So I had total control of it then, really.
Wow.
And so getting the team on board was crucial. I think other lesson I would have probably had then would be it's okay to fail. You know, I was entering competitions at this stage because I knew there was an importance in it. And that was my first taste of competitions. And I think actually another lesson would be maybe don't open your mouth so quick. I haven't learned that lesson.
I was about to say.
I just know that it was a lesson. Because I remember I'd got to the top three in Scotland on my first attempt for Fish and Chip Shop of the Year. And I went to previous winners that I knew to tell them. I was so buzzing. And I asked them for some advice. And then later that week, it was announced who the other finalists were. And they were finalists. So there was a lesson to me then. They didn't tell me wrong information, but it was like, maybe you need to just keep things to your chest a little bit longer. So that would have been a lesson back then.
So I mean nowadays when people come to you for like Forked Up, is the main challenge these restaurant owners, hospitality owners have, is it to do with staff and you realise that early on, or there are lots of other things going on?
To be honest, most of the folk that have come to me or are talking to me just now about coming on board, staffing isn't probably in everyone's agenda.
Okay.
They're struggling to find staff, which is a big hospitality problem. Struggling to keep staff, which is a them problem, not a hospitality problem. But staffing is probably one of the biggest things, and their own time.
And so did you realise that early on when you were trying to run this restaurant?
Well, I knew these were problems that I had earlier on. Staffing not really has been, ever been a problem for me.
Okay.
And I used to say that was luck. And it's not until I was interviewed the other week, and then I thought, it ain't actual luck. Actually, I've created this. You know, that's not been appreciative of myself. Whereas before, I told you I've changed. So before, I would have just shoved that off as luck. But now I actually understand that's not luck. I've created that world around me. And that's what I'm trying to do with these other people, make them realise they've got to learn to not tell staff what to do. You've got to coach them. You've got to teach them.
And I know before, well, ages ago, I'm sure we talked about sometimes, you know, you get staff different ages and experience, but sometimes almost like the ones who come with no experience, but they are hungry to learn, they could often be the best because they almost like haven't come with anything they need to unlearn.
Yeah, I think I've only employed one person that's come from hospitality. I take everyone and mould them. So for most folk, I would say it's like plasticine, but because of your age group, we'll say morph.
Morph, yeah.
You'll know what morph is.
Of course, Tony Hart's still around.
I doubt it. He was probably about 90 when he was doing that programme. So,
I
like to get people and mould them. So no one joins me, well, apart from this guy that I employed 6 months ago. No one comes to me and goes straight into a major role. They come in and they make their way around every department in the business.
Oh, okay.
Because that way, it means that everyone's got an understanding. So there's no if a supervisor has to go and jump on the sink to do dishes, they know what to do. If something goes wrong on the till, they know how to deal with it. If there's a problem with a customer, they know how to deal with it. There's no point mastering the toughest job and not knowing the easiest job.
So is that the same at like? Because obviously you know some top level serious chefs. Is that the same pretty much across the restaurant world that everyone knows a bit of every aspect of the kitchen? Or is it like, no, I'm a pastry chef, that's all I do.
I think for the level of chef and that you're talking about, they do what I do. People have to go through all sections. Unless you've come to a business, so like say we were at Stephen Edwards at Etch the other month. If someone came in there and they were head chef, they might go straight in as head chef, but they would probably have to go and make sure they go into every department to understand the departments first. Pastry chefing's a bit different. If it's a speciality that they've gained, they're more likely to go straight into that. But they still learn other departments.
Okay. God, I was watching the MasterChef semi-final last night on catch-up, and they were at that Ikoi, is it pronounced, where Paul ate a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah.
Holy shit, that tasting menu looked amazing.
We, me and Victoria...
You been there?
Me and Victoria just... We're waiting for you to invite me.
I'm taking you to the Beefy Boys today.
Just checking to make sure you pick that up. So yeah, we watched that the other day, and I tell you what, it's quite funny when you look at a lot of these chefs that are.
Does he look young as well?
Yeah, these chefs that are coming out of the box now, a lot of them are self-taught. Okay, they're going and doing stages in places, but they've not been handed this. They've come from another career like he had. Fuck me.
He was in banking or something, wasn't he? And it was Jeremy Chan, yeah.
The passion and the knowledge and the skill set, it just oozed. But you've seen the way... Actually, it's a prime example. You've seen the way he spoke and handled the young chefs that he had. Now, let's face it. Them chefs were young. There's a 22-year-old and a 24-year-old that are now in the finals. Fucking hell, look how good they are.
I know.
At that age. How's that possible? It's crazy. But the way he spoke to them was... how you're getting the best out of people. I know that you've got the Ramsay shouty mentality. That has a place, and folk that...
Does that still go on a bit, do you think?
I think in some old school places, but a lot of people won't put up with that anymore, so they probably would struggle. The people that would go to like Ramsay's for that, they're signing up to go to that now. You know, that they know that's what they're going for. No one's going into that environment not expecting that. He has his ways of how he gets out of people, and I don't think it's as bad as what is portrayed, but I think there is better ways now. I think it's been proven there's better ways to get the best out of people.
So if I was to sort of recall that team back from your first ever restaurant, I know a long time ago now, what do you think they'd say about, I guess, your first stab at effectively running a business and managing a team?
It's a tough one, actually. Quite often, I see them on Christmas night out. I take my staff out.
Oh, okay.
And then we go out, or like the Strathaven Beer Festival, a sponsor and a cook-up. And quite a lot of the time, I see these guys at it. And a lot of them will come and say, you are my first job. And thank you. And it's really quite nice, you know. And it's not like I'm doing it for that. And I think that was another transition for me, actually. I'll say what's quite difficult, and probably a lot of my clients and other people in the industry don't accept, is especially in fish and chips, a lot of the staff that we're going to get, it's first job. And it's only a stepping stone because they're going to college, uni, or they just need some money for Christmas. We've got to accept that. We've got to still treat them like they're going to be there forever. Mm-hmm. Give them the training. Invest in them. Because you might get another year out of them. You might get another 6 months out of them. Or you just get the best version of them when they're there, rather than them just turning up, putting their hand out for their wage slip, not caring, and going home. So if you treat people like this early on, and you understand that it's a stepping stone and they'll probably move on, then it's less a problem when they move on, because you've already accepted that this is only a stepping stone, rather than, you know it's coming, here's my notice, I'm leaving, and you throw the toys out the pram, and you go tits. But you knew it was coming. Mm. Whereas now, we ask the question every month, how are you getting on? Any plans for the next 12 months? What do you need from us? Are you still thinking about going to uni? When is it? No problems. So now we start recruiting around that, rather than waiting for the bomb to drop, which we knew was dropping anyway. So it's an us problem, like I said earlier on. It's not really their problem. It's a first job. What's important is we focus on the core team, the ones that are there long term, the head chef, you know, your senior staff, your full timers. Focus on them and focus on the rest of the team, but accept the rest of the team are passers-by.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But I suppose everyone who works for a growing business has got to be hungry. And, you know, our motto here is stay hungry. And often people, I guess everyone thinks they're hungry, but what are the kind of warning bells for you? Say if you're interviewing someone for a job and you know they haven't got the experience, so you're going to train them up. How do you spot how hungry they are? And what are the kind of warning signs that make you think, you don't want this bad enough?
You can pick it up pretty quick. But we put them in trial shifts as well.
Okay.
But again, everyone's on about COVID was a nightmare, and it was a nightmare everywhere. But there's actually a lot of positives came from it. We learned a lot. We learned a lot about how to look at our business. And one of the things that changed was the recruitment for me. I used to have them come down for the first interview at the shop, and they would come down nervous. I'd be busy. So I probably didn't have the patience for them. I was wanting to get back on service. You know, it was like just fitting them in for me. And it probably wasn't the best experience for either party.
Right.
But COVID, I started doing Zoom and saying, let's book a Zoom. And it also meant I didn't have to go down to the shop to fit them in. They were late and it would be like, I had that mental Navy mentality. Fuck you, you're late. Mm-hmm. If you can't turn up in time now, fuck off. And that was it. Whereas Zoom, bear in mind, as young kids, realistically, most of them, they were happy to do Zoom. You're interviewing them in their living room or in their mum's living room, in their bedrooms, and they're sitting there comfortable in their own environment. Mm-hmm. It was more relaxed. Still could be nervous, but it was like more normal for them. They're all FaceTiming and stuff all the time. It was convenient for us both because we would agree a time. No one had to make an effort to meet somewhere. They just had to get on the end of their phone or front of a screen. And it just changed it up a little bit. And it again, you've got to be willing to make change. And I thought, I like this. Mm-hmm. And I've kept it like that now. So I don't interview them at the shop at all.
Okay.
I interview them on Zoom. And then
I got a question for you then.
Go on.
What do you think about this, right? So we were interviewing someone, and basically for a supplier role, not an employed role, mm-hmm. And they were Zooming from their bedroom, and they hadn't put a filter on or anything like that.
Yeah.
And so you could see that they were sat in front of an unmade bed.
Yeah.
Now, as a Navy man,
yeah.
I'm not a Navy man, but yeah. I imagine that would rankle with you, but me and Joel saw
what
that.
What's his name? Seaman Stains.
Yeah, make a note to edit that out. Yeah, but it's like, that was almost enough for us, that warning bell to think, even if you don't make your bed usually, at least make it if it's going to be in the fucking background of your Zoom.
Yeah, I think I get that. Like, I've had parents behind the screen and I can hear them, like, try to tell them what to answer. And it's like, I feel like saying, I'm not employing you. But I get that. But you're employing kind of different to me. You're wanting people that are, you need folk that have got, are arty-farty. But then, I think I would still take them. Because old me wouldn't have. This would have been old me Navy. You should be making your bed first thing, and I get it. Mm-hmm. It is effort. But on the other hand, we don't know the circumstance of that. A dog could have just come and ruffled that up. You don't know that. They maybe were nervous. They maybe have got anxiety. Let's face it, we've got to deal with that now. But they might be the best person for your job. So maybe that would be first interview, and you take them in here and say, right, let's see what they're like. A little mini rehearsal of what the job's going to be then. So a bit like what we're doing, we would take them in, and if they come in now, like a bag of shit, unironed clothes, and then I would be thinking, right, this is a problem. So yeah, actually, this ain't going to go much further. So that would probably be my second point. But I would probably let them take that next step. Old me wouldn't have.
Because there's another marketer we know, and yeah, when they're interviewing, they do get people to come and basically work in the office for a day.
Yeah.
And just so you can actually see hands-on what are they like.
Yeah.
That, and maybe that's the next step for us.
Well, I would do that because this is what we started. I used to just take them on. Yes, no. And I used to think, well, we can get a DA within a year if it doesn't work out, or they might go. But actually, this works both ways. So you could say, right, you know what? We'll take you in for a trial day or a trial week or whatever, you know. They'll come in, but tell them, this isn't a trial for me. It's a trial for you. You might not like the job. Mm. So even if you think they're shit hot, they might not like it. They might not like the environment. So then they can make the decision, no, it's okay. I don't think we're going to carry on. Now you've still got other people in the pipeline that you can have another trial. Otherwise, you take people on, you tell folk, no, sorry, thank you, we don't need you today, and then this person was a bag of shit. So I would give them all a trial shift.
Okay.
There's nothing to lose by doing that.
And how have you found recruiting, like, since COVID? Like, you mentioned hospitality struggling throughout. Is recruitment a big part of that? There's just not enough people wanting jobs that there were before? Or are you still having steady streams of applicants when you are recruiting?
Like I said, we're quite lucky. I've got good staff retention.
Okay.
So we don't generally need to recruit a lot of folk. It's normally the come and goers that we need to recruit, which is easy. There's loads of them out there. The quality of people that apply now is a bit mixed.
Okay.
So some people, it's like, you do know you applied for this job. You know, it's like, fucking hell, put at least a bit of effort. At least lie. You know what I mean? Don't just sit there and say shit all. But I think if you were looking for skilled set, I think it would be harder because a lot of people that have got the skill set took COVID and moved on.
they decided, you know what, I don't need responsibility. I don't need to work all these hours. So they've taken jobs like delivery drivers for Tesco's, right, and stuff, okay, whereas they can make decent money and work for themselves almost. But there is good people out there. I think you've just got you've got to be known for being a good recruiter. You've got to be known to be treating people well. You know, like you guys here, you know, you've got your pool table, you've got a good atmosphere in this office. So actually, you do want to take people here and give them a trial. Let them see what you've got, because all they see is your brand. Let them come in and see what you've got.
So what kind of tips do you have for anyone listening for staff retention? Because like you say, retention is much better than having to go through the pain of recruiting.
So I think staff retention builds a relationship, because it's about relationships. So for like me, I've got a lot of youngsters, and maybe not so much now, but when I was in the business at the co-front all the time, I was like an agony aunt, an uncle, a dad, you know, to everyone, everyone's problems. And that was good, because I don't take it home with me, but I do go out to help them. You need to have an open door approach, so that if someone has a problem, so like during COVID, one of the girls told us that she had mental health issues. Right. So we put all the staff on a mental health course from home, because we thought that'll help the girl. Yeah. And it's, let's all be open and help each other. Got to pay them well.
Okay.
So like, we're real living wage employers, first folk in fish and chip industry in the UK to be in it. So we pay the KP, so the kitchen porter gets the same money as a person dishing up the fish and chips. Because for me, the person doing the dishes is as important as the person dishing it up. The only people that get more money is the person frying it, or chefing, and their runner, because they've taken on a bit more responsibility. But, and also the lesson I learned when I was in the Navy, I was on a junior's wage because I was 16. So I was out in the Gulf at 17 on probably £400 a month.
Blimey.
Whereas all the other guys were all on £1,000. But my boss put in for me to get a temporary raise to the, it was like an acting normal wage, because I was doing the job of an adult anyway. And I got it. And I remember the feeling of being skint, doing the same job, and then being equal to them. And I liked that. So when I started the real living wage, I decided, you know what, an 18-year-old does need the same amount of money as a 22-year-old. Mm-hmm. They want a car, they want a holiday, they might want to buy a house. And in this day and age, you need to start saving a little bit earlier than back in the day when you didn't have to have so much money.
And what, you were the first, what, fish and chip business to do that?
In the UK, yeah.
Blimey.
So like, we pay everyone the same.
Wow.
And it means it, and it's above national minimum wage. So it gives them a good wage. I mean, it costs me money, but you know what? Let them leave. That's probably why we get a lot of attention. Why would you leave us getting paid £11.50 for doing dishes when you probably get £4.50 from the place along the road? And that's fact. You know, you'd have to work three times the amount of hours. The other one is the hours. Try and accommodate with what they want. Try and, so I shut at 10 o'clock. When COVID came, I shut at 9, and then I moved it to 8:30 because eating habits had changed. So you've got to be adaptable.
And you do online deliveries. So was that a COVID thing, or was that around before COVID?
Well, bit of both. But what I'd done was I now shut at 8 o'clock, and because I've seen the staff happy. Staff are going home at 8:30, 9 o'clock at the latest in the summer. They're going home, and they can still go out with their mates. They can still have a life. They can still have a family. Because that's the problem with having the older people. They don't want to work weekends every weekend, shut at 10, summer, Christ, that's 11:30, you're getting home. It's a long old day. So a customer said to me on social media, the platform for the gobshites, they said, can't believe I came down to your business and you were shut at 8 o'clock, it's fucking disgrace, bam, bam, bam. I replied, I don't normally entertain these folk, but I thought, fuck you, I'm having you. And I said, look, I shut 8 o'clock so my staff can have a life. Because he said, I'm making too much money. That's why I do it.
Okay.
And I said,
just some idiot you didn't know?
I don't know who it is. So I replied and said, I close to give my staff a life. And actually, it's costing me a fortune. That 2 hours in the
prime
summer,
time.
It's like £2,000 a day.
Shit.
Do you know what I mean? So I thought, fuck you. And then he says, well, it's an easy solution, employ more staff. And I thought, well, no, because it means someone's still working till 11 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
So I don't want that. I don't want that anymore. The money's not the crucial thing here. It's about keeping a happy team. You look at the amount of restaurants now, and I know it's double-sided, that only open maybe 4 or 5 days.
Mm-hmm.
But it's brilliant for them now, because it means they need one head chef, because that head chef's in control. If they're open 7 days a week and they're open 12 hours a day, say, that chef can't do all that. So you need double skill set. So you now we've created more consistency. So like we shot on a Monday now through the winter, and it means it's a bagged off day off. And it just creates consistency, happy team, and that's important.
So all these years running the Bay, when did it get to the point where you realised, fucking hell, right, the Navy, working with your first wife, the restaurant, then the Bay, all the awards you won?
The Bay wasn't next.
Oh, okay.
No. So when I came away from first wife, I helped a company that had a shop, but I was looking at purchasing a bankrupt fish and chip shop in Stonehaven. It was called The Haven. It's where the deep fried Mars bar came from.
Okay.
It was probably bankrupt. So, and I had a business partner, a silent business partner then. The most vocal silent business partner I'd ever had. So it's actually a really good business learning curve for me, actually.
Oh, okay.
This part of my life.
Right.
So 6 years I was there. I swear I won Young Fish Fry of the Year. And it was great. Great business. Jesus, we turned that around. But I was known as a Führer. So I'd come from the Navy. And I was a bastard, you know. And I look back, folk would turn up and not shave, and I'd say, fucking go home and get a shave. And I'm like, fuck me, look at me now, I've got a beard, right? But it's like, folk didn't sign up for this. They didn't sign up for the Navy. They were coming to work in a fish and chip shop. And I was out of control. But it's
so what happened then? Because it sounds like you were in control in the first restaurant.
No, I was, but now this is my own business. So okay. I suppose I was probably still like that in this other one, but I was in my own business. My money was in it. I really needed to make this work. I was under pressure, and I just was strict.
Right, okay.
I was still fun time Frankie, but I was strict when it needed to be, let's get head down and crack on.
Strict because of stress? Was it like loss of pressure on?
Nah, I think it was strict. It was that Navy training.
Okay.
Things had to be immaculate. Everything had to be facing the same way. You know, it was like Navy taught you bullshit baffles brains. Captain's rounds every night. You know, you'd coil the plug, it goes in the sink with the, so it doesn't draw your eye to a mess. It was that attention to detail. But that's what won me Young Fryer of the Year. The judges turned up to the shop and it looked like an old cottage. And it was old inside, old equipment, but I'd put all my money into buying it.
Well, sometimes also, if you can't do the little things well, why trust you with the big things?
Yeah.
Like one of Joel's things here with our drinks fridge, all the cans, the labels, should all be facing outwards.
Yeah.
And at first, some people might think, well, why the fuck? But then, of course, you get to realise
that
little things like that are important, and the compound effect, they all add up to give a good impression.
100%. And that's what happened. So when the judges came in for Young Fryer, they said to me, wow, place was immaculate. Even though it was old and tired, it was immaculate. Everything had a place. If it wasn't getting used, it wasn't there. So the attention to detail then had now created. So that aspect had created me the winning formula for that. But the main point in this would have been, as I was growing, my business partner didn't like it.
Right, okay.
It was a bit of a jealousy thing. He took back control of the business, like finances. But he didn't like, he was old school, he was at the end of his career, didn't like paying people. So I'd be getting messages from the fish supplier, potato supplier, we need money. And I'm looking at the bank account, it's full of money, and I'm saying, we need to pay them. And this was annoying me, because my relationship with these customers, these clients, suppliers was now getting a bit fractured. And he had habits that I didn't like. He was old school. So I'd had enough. So I decided enough's enough.
Right, and then came the Bay then. Set up 100% your own.
It took 2 years to get rid of this guy.
Shit, right,
so
okay.
So solicitors, you know.
Okay.
He took 51% of the business, I had 49%. He'd actually taken out a bridging loan instead of putting his money in, and he charged the bridging loan through the business. This is what I found out.
Wow.
This is why I got upset. So he had no money to put in, but he'd borrowed money against. So I was the only one that originally put money in. Then he made his wife a partner, a director, so it was 2-1 vote.
So he
changed the solicitor to his solicitor. So you see the pattern here. I could have rolled over easy, but I went for advice, and I paid big money for this solicitor, and it's probably the best thing I'd done.
Wow.
So he'd actually put the shop up for sale to get me out, but he couldn't get me out because I said I wasn't moving. I was an employee as well as a director. So it was messy.
Okay.
We had to outbid each other for our own business. And in the end, I walked. I took my money.
and I built the bay from there.
So lesson, number one lesson from that relationship?
Yeah, don't have a business partner.
Okay, I won't tell Joel that.
Yeah.
51-49, similar thing happened with Emma's father.
Yeah.
And yeah, that majority sometimes.
I think sometimes you need a majority because someone does need the power, but I don't think that's a long-term relationship. You know, I think that's not going to work.
Mm.
I think partnerships have got a place.
Do most people who come to you for help, are they mostly guys or ladies on their own?
I've got a mix.
Okay.
I've got a mix. But most of the partnerships are either brothers or partners.
Okay.
As in sexual partners.
Blimey. So you've left that, start up the bay, yep. Obviously winning awards, sustainability.
Well, so awards for me, I was always into awards, but when I came away from the Karen, I wasn't allowed to advertise, I'd moved.
Oh, right, okay.
That was part of the agreement. So I thought, okay then, if I win awards, I'm not advertising, that's free publicity. And that's where I got, And I thought, do you know what? I know what will hurt this person is by going out and working hard and being the best.
Mm.
So it made me, I've always said, when your back's against the wall, it's when you perform the best.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're financially in a corner,
mm-hmm.
you know what? You double down and you make it happen. It's when you get complacent, when you get comfortable.
Yeah, the comfort zone. Yeah, very dangerous place to be.
Yeah.
Yeah, so how long have you had the bay for now then?
So the bay is 17 years.
Wow. And when did you realise, or when did you start thinking, actually, I've amassed a shitload of knowledge. I could use that to help other business owners. When did those kind of seeds start getting sown?
So I was doing consultancy work for past 10 years.
Okay.
Going around businesses all over the world, helping people open businesses or helping them set up. And I loved it. But the problem I had was they were controlling my time. So let's just say, and it wasn't necessarily them. So like the gas engineer might be late at coming and putting the gas into a building, so it would delay by a fortnight maybe for the opening of someone's restaurant. And then they would say, we're not opening for 2 weeks. And I'd be like, shit, I'm going on holiday in 2 weeks. So now I can't deliver on what I promised. And it's like, so it made me hold back on what I was enjoying doing. And it kind of, then I started getting coached. And our coach turned around and said to me, I don't know why you're not coaching people, because you know, this would be your route. And it made me think, you know what? Actually, that's a great idea. So we came up with this idea on my full day mastermind with them. I drove home from South Shields back to Aberdeen. I come up with the name and came up with the concept on that 6-hour drive.
So when was this? What year was this then?
A year ago now.
That's a year ago.
Exactly a year ago now.
Wow. And what do you enjoy the most about what you do? You mentioned way back at the beginning about, you know, seeing people smile, helping people, but what were the particular aspects of the coaching that make you think that was a good day?
I think when I see, again, smile from other people, seeing people succeed, seeing people change, because change is there for everyone. You know, no matter how good you think you are, there's mm-hmm. always change. If I look back to when I won Fish and Chip Shot of the Year, I'm chalk and cheese. For Young Fry of the Year, even further back, I'm chalk and cheese. Even to a year ago myself, I'm a different person. You've got to be willing to make a change and adapt. COVID taught us that for prime. You know, if we're not willing to make changes, we're going to probably sink the ship. So I think it also gives me a pat on the back because I sometimes don't accept how much knowledge I have or how good I am. And it's not until I see the reaction from the other people. So like when they forked up, they come to the bay, you get to work with me for the day at the bay or on Bay on the Road, or I can come to their business. But the clients that have come to mine, I've seen what they're like in the shop. And then they've turned around and said, that's the nugget of gold. I said, how's that? And they said, because you're out the door, you're cooking, you're teaching me, your staff are getting on with it, and it's smooth as anything, right? You've done twice as much money as I would have in that lunch service, whereas we'd be shouting, chips on, chips on, someone get this. And it's just calm and collected. And it's that Navy mentality, I think. It's just because it's rehearsed. And everyone knows what they're doing. We've got specific jobs, so we all know what our place is. And I take that for granted.
So is it quite, not easy, you know, it's built on experience, but is it quite simple for you to see where the points of friction are in a business that maybe the business owner is blind to?
Yeah, I think so. And I think a lot of the time it's, you know, So people will turn around and say, I'm struggling to keep staff, or, and I'll say, it's not the staff. I think it's possibly you. You know, you're maybe your approach. Okay. You've overcomplicated it. Do the staff know what their job role is? No. Right, well, maybe we need to start with the basics. And most folk don't have that. They don't have exactly a job spec. So not only do you know what that person's meant to be doing, but they know what they're meant to be doing. Mm. So we've got to get it from ground level and build it back up. And it's not realistically difficult, but they've got to drop their ego and be willing to make change.
I mean, some people say that, you know, every problem's a leadership problem. I mean, have you encountered people who simply aren't coachable? They just, they think they are, but they're not. They won't listen and they refuse to accept part of that responsibility.
Yeah, I think that's definitely been the case. Some people, but then sometimes you think, I've coached people and thought they've not had anything out of it, and then they've said they've enjoyed it, and I'm like, shit in hell, how's that happened? But they've not all done full deep like what I would, but then that's why I'm doing what I do. I mean, I'm different, I accept that. But some people are just uncoachable, but that's where I would let them finish their 90-day training with me, and I wouldn't invite them into the one-year program. Okay. Because they maybe would want to be in it, but it would probably draw it down for everyone else that's in it. It's not the environment I want to create. But the penny will drop with them people later on at one point in life. I 100% believe it. But this is where it's quite good when, if it's partners and they've come to meet together, and I'll say, right, well, we'll do it under one umbrella. And you can see one person will excel and one isn't. But what it find is the other person rebels a little bit, but then they see the other person excel and then they jump on board and then they get on the game with it. So it can work that way as well.
Okay. So is that how it works with Forked Up then? So people come on board for 3 months first, and then depending on their actions and the relationship, they then will get accepted onto like the year-long program.
Yeah, so if I see that they've done what they've been asked to do, and also I see the improvement in their willingness, and also if they're financially capable of being in it, I wouldn't want anyone to break the camel's back just to be in my program. You know, it's not what it's about. So as long as I could see that it was bringing added value to them, I'll carry on giving them value, and I would invite them in for the year.
And would you, or have you ever considered coaching people who maybe aren't in the hospitality business, or is like, no, it's food and drink for you? Because I guess the rules can be applied to most businesses, but what your niche is.
I 100% believe I could coach pretty much any business, but I've got a niche. So I think I would just go in a pool of load of coaches. I'm doing what I do, and I'm known for being good at what I do. I'm not known for being good in code break. You know, although I could come here and put some good ideas in, it's not my niche. It's not my network. So stick to what you know. Don't dilute what you're good at, because that's all you would do, is you'd just be diluting what you're shit hot at, and then you just become one of everyone else.
So, I mean, definitely a commonality between us and a lot of the people we mix with.
Height.
Is... Well, I was going to say intelligence and dedication, but no, I was going to say journaling, which I used to think was a load of bollocks.
Yeah.
And I talked to some people, and they also turns out they used to think it was a load of bollocks. But I've been journaling for years now. You probably even longer. Do you want to tell me sort of what part of that plays in your program, and what part of that journaling plays in your own personal business life?
So exactly same as me, dyslexic. A pen and paper is a total no-no, and it. It was something I just thought, what a load of shite, you know. And it was like meditation, you know, what a fucking bullshit, you know. And this is my mindset. And I just thought, that's rubbish. But I always thought, I've done all right without it. I don't need it. I manage without having a calendar. I manage. Fuck me. I don't know how I got where I got. Honestly, I look back now and I think, I was flying by seat of my pants. You know, I got up every day and took every day on the nose. Let's go. Let's have it. Let's bring it on. And I smashed every day, but I was working my arse off. Then I started journaling, and it was like, yeah, okay, whatever. Started filling it in, but then it was pretty good for me, because I didn't do it for a business reason. I started journaling for a personal reason. I had problems with personal life, and also I'd lost a manager that I had 22 years. And it affected me, not in business, it affected me personally. I took it quite personal. It was like a son to me, and I found it difficult. So this journaling became really good way of structuring my day, but also preempting shit that was a way to happen. So I knew I was going to pick my kids up and there could be shit to fly with it. So I preempted what was going to happen, and all of a sudden it was like, well, it didn't bother me. Whereas I would have gone down that route, a bit like what I said earlier on with the staff coming and going. Mm. I knew they were going to go. So it's like scaling that back to a daily thing. You knew that this problem could come and hit you in the chin today. So if what will I do if that problem comes? So when the problem did come, you've already managed to deal with it and move on without thinking about it. Whereas you're really in the back of your head before, you knew it was coming, you just wouldn't admit it was coming, and then you would throw all the toys out of the pram. I don't know why, probably just to let everyone know that you were there. So journaling was good for me. And that question, I know Victoria hates it, but I liked the preempting one. She doesn't like that one. Everyone's different and gets different areas of like thriving out of it. But for me, I can look back on my day and see what's working, what's not working. And also, having four things to do a day instead of trying to do 104. And actually, the 104 things that I used to try and do, I got two of them done, and there would be another five things at the bottom of that list. Yeah. So the list just got bigger and bigger and bigger, which then puts you down in a dump. Whereas choosing four things, you probably get six things done. Or if not, you get two things done. But guess what? It's two good things, two structured things that have created some direction.
That's probably the best answer I've had to that journaling question. How long would you say it took you consistently journaling before you started thinking, shit, I think this is actually working, you know? Because you can't just probably give it 3 days, think, right, that's shit. Was there a moment for you when you thought, well...
Probably my 45-day review.
Oh, okay.
And I thought, shit, now have I done all this? So it was reflection. And then I thought, this is working. I started buying into it. I hadn't missed a day because I'm a committer. You know, this is that forces mentality. When I commit to something, I'm committing. I don't ever say I'm going to do something and half-ass do it. So I committed, I filled it in, and I filled it in every single day. Mm. Even when I was away on a hike for 14 days in the wilderness, I was putting it on my phone. But the 45-day review, it made me realise it works. And I was bought. I was bought into it. And that was it for me. It was just like, this has a purpose.
Yeah, it's strange, isn't it? So many people I've talked to had the same feeling as us, that yeah, it's writing in a fucking diary in the forest, clapping cymbals together.
Yeah,
don't need it before.
You don't need cymbals.
Yeah. Everyone needs cymbals. They kept coming back to the six words.
Well, you can get the clap, but you now know in the journal that you've got to go to doctors in the morning to deal with the clap. It's a different clap. Oh, okay.
Fucking hell. The six words that will kill any business. We've always done it this way. And like you say, I didn't need journaling before and I've done all right. Or I've always done this and that's always worked. But like you say, you're running around like a blue-ass fire. You feel busy. But the things you need to do, you haven't done because you've been busy trying to like solve the world's problems.
It's that old word of busy fool.
Knowing those non-negotiables that are going to move you forward
before
you get pulled into other people's circuses.
Calendar. It's probably a game changer for me. So, like, I wouldn't have had a calendar, you know. For me, I just wouldn't.
Yeah.
Actually, I'd have probably been a rebel against it. And I tried it for a while, but I didn't buy into it. I didn't do it properly. You know, I was putting some things. And then because it feels like a burden. So, like, a prime example would be gym. So, I'm going to do the gym. So, on a Sunday, I choose what days I'm doing the gym. Actually, that's the wrong answer. So, now let's choose. This is the days I'm going to do the gym. And I'll put it in my calendar and repeat. So it's now in my calendar forever. I can move it if I want, but it's in there. So now it's not a hassle, it's in. You know, so like in the business, I'm getting the range service, right? Okay, let's get that booked in now. What do you mean? Let's book it in now for next year.
Yep.
Bang, it's in. So now we don't have to, it's in there. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, so my calendar, all the way up till I go on holiday later next year, it's wedged. But it's wedged the things I want to do. It's wedged the things that I enjoy, or it's important. You know, so it's, and I've got more free time. I'm doing more of the things I love doing because I can control my day. Mm. Whereas before, I was flying by the seat of my pants.
And sometimes that flying by the seat of your pants, it can be exciting.
Yeah.
And you think, shit, this is great. But like you say, in terms of knowing what your goal is and are you actually on the most direct path there, probably not. So you might end up in the same place, but it'll just take you shitloads longer.
Yeah.
And you probably burnt yourself out doing it.
Well, I think there's a prime example as well. As I was always a book a holiday just before a holiday. Let's get a deal. There's no deals to be had nowadays anyway. Mm. You end up getting a second rate holiday that you really want on a, not the date you want, you know, and it just, it doesn't work. But that's, or what happened is you'd say, I'll book a holiday in the summer, and then summer would be over and you think, shit, I'm not on a holiday. That would have been old me. Whereas now, I'm booking way ahead. I'm saying, fuck it, let's go to Jamaica in January. When? Let's choose the flight we want, the time we want, and it's perfect. It's in your calendar, it's done. A lot of businesses say, I can't get time off. And I'll say, that's funny. You just come back from holiday. Yeah. So you've just had time off. Yeah, but it was a lot of work for me to get to that stage. So just put that work in every week. So then you can have that all the time. That is, and it becomes easier and easier and easier. That's what folk have got to do. They've got to get into habit.
Yeah, that thing about, oh, I don't have enough time. Usually I just say to people, show me what your screen time is.
Yeah,
big time. Shit, 6 hours a day. It's like, yeah, it's mad, isn't it? So I've got a couple of, to round things up, got a couple of big questions for you, a couple of easy ones. Big one, what's been your biggest achievement in life? And then what's been your biggest achievement in business?
Oh, biggest achievement in life? Personal life?
Yeah.
Fuck me. That's a difficult one. My personal life has had many high and many, many low. But usually my highs come on a bounce of a low. I'd probably say my biggest personal achievement is meeting Victoria.
Oh, okay.
She's been real solid rock for
me. When was that?
So she started stalking me 5 years ago, I think it was.
Well, stalking you what, on the socials?
Yeah, stalking me, yeah. Stalking me, and then she started like turning up to my van. Then actually, I got in, what was that book? Fuck. I got the highest entry in World Eating Experiences in the UK. I've got the highest entry in the UK. It's number 32 in the world, it was. Lonely Planet Guide, that's what it was. And the day that came out, I didn't know anything about it. It was all over the news. And I was like, fucking hell. And it social blew up. I was on Chris Evans' show and everything with it. And Victoria had dropped a bottle of gin off at the shop. I never met this girl, right?
Right.
And someone said, this girl from the golf course, she had a restaurant at the golf course, has dropped a bottle of gin off for you. And someone said to me, that I know, because I posted a picture of it, who's your next victim? That's what they said. But then that's when we started talking, you know, and then that was it. We clicked.
Blimey.
We were like chalk and cheese.
I didn't know she used to run a restaurant.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. She came out of that to help me. So
wow. So I'm in business with my wife.
Yeah.
You are. Not everyone get their head around that, can they?
No, but we are chalk and cheese.
And so, is that why it works then? Yeah, you've got your lane, she's got hers.
Yeah, 100%. So like, she keeps me in check. I keep her in check. Probably more her and me, to be honest. But, you know, like Victoria is methodical. She is, she's a thinker.
Mm.
So she'll think about things. She'll write things down. She'll plan things. I'm a doer. This is how it'll work. I'll say, Victoria, I'm thinking about doing this. What do you think? And she'll say, no, I don't think so. That's fine. And I do it anyway. But I need her. I need that reassurance. I like someone to bounce things off of. But she is a real level, solid platform for me.
So on the old disc profile personality, that's you be a DI, she be an SC or something.
100%.
Yeah, like me and M.
Yeah.
Amazing. What about biggest achievement in business? Is there a particular award that stands out for a particular reason? Because you won quite a few.
Yeah, I would say four big awards. I'll say four big awards, right? Young Friday of the Year was a pat on the back early on to me, like, this is a career and it's a way forward and you're doing something right.
Mm-hmm.
So it made me think, stick to what you're doing. Something is working here. Fish and Chip Shop of the Year. A lot of folk win it and it's like, that's it, done. Me, it was this has cracked a door open. I'm going to boot the fuck out the rest of the doors and I'm going to make it happen. And that's what I've done. Out of all the previous winners, you know, I mean, I will say I've probably excelled more than anyone in bucking the trend, not just opening more shops. I've, you know, changed my career into many different paths. But that opened the door into many things. I think I wanted to win a Katie's. Katie's is a hospitality award for a caterer. And that's where all the Michelin chefs go. So all the top chefs win all these awards. Sat Baines and such like all try to win this awards. I'd wanted to be in amongst that mix. And
I entered a sustainability award, didn't get anywhere, entered again, didn't get anywhere. I like getting a hit in the face and getting back up. And I judged an award for the Katies, and they had a seafood restaurant of the year award. So I got to meet some of the judges, and they were, one of the judges, she was an inspector. I went there, and I'm a vocal guy, so I went there to say what I thought, you know. It was restaurant of the year, not chef of the year, so let's be realistic. And she tweeted to me when I left that award judging, met Callum Richardson today. Wow, what a knowledge of sustainability and environment and everything, you know. And that was, I think I maybe changed some people's minds.
Okay.
Instead of just looking, oh, it's just fish and chips, it's just fish and chips. I always wanted to be in the room in London with 600 of the best chefs in the world. I wanted to be there with them. And I got in that room during COVID, so I had to stay in my living room. Fucking nightmare. So I won the Katies during COVID.
Blimey.
So it was a real high. It was something I wanted to do for so long, but I didn't get to get into that party mix.
But like I say, to get, you know, it doesn't matter how many times you get knocked down, it's how many times you get back up, isn't it?
So. Yeah, but if you want emotion, the biggest emotional award was this year when I got Entrepreneur of the Year for Ex-Armed Forces. So
wow.
It was someone I used to be in the Navy with. They sent me the application, said, you've got to enter this. I looked at it, I delegated it to Victoria. She wrote it, and it's good because she writes it the way she sees it, it's fresh eyes, and she'll sing my praises, put in for it. Next thing I was told, I was in the final, and it was embargoed. I was buzzing. I was so buzzing because it was like getting recognition from an industry, so the forces that I loved and respected and still respect. Mm-hmm. It was like... That'll do for me. Sure. You know, it was a pat in the back.
So how many in the final?
I think it was 10 businesses, but it was 1,000 people we were in the...
Shit.
It was at Dorchester, I think it was, in London. And the head of Barclays Bank was on the stage and announced the winner. And I took my mate, it was in the Navy with me, engineer, who's now a commander.
Oh, is this the picture I saw you and your kilt?
Yeah, he's a commander.
Right.
So I was just thinking it was just going to be like a reunion. I wanted to, I think it was like 34 years to the day that he'd been in the Navy. He signed up.
Wow.
So it was like, well done to him. And then they called my name out, Victoria Yelps. I'm up on the stage, me doing a selfie with the crowd. And it was like, that was quite an emotional thing. And then the next day, the messages I was getting from ex-forces and stuff, and it was like, you know what? That made me feel good. That made me feel good about myself. Mm. And I think the ones that are not in your industry are even more special because it's a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Amazing.
So that'll be my biggest achievement.
Bloody hell. And that is one hell of an achievement. Right, a couple of easy ones for you now.
All right.
Wrap up. Quick fire. Favourite film?
Shawshank Redemption.
Oh, nice. Ooh. Nice, love that film. Favourite mistake? Not so easy, this one.
Favourite mistake? Going into business partnership.
Okay.
It's been my biggest curve. I learned early about people and about people, what they get out of you and what you get out of them, and trust. So that mistake early on in my life was a good mistake to have then, because if I had it now, it would be costly.
Wow, amazing. Callum, as ever, it's been fantastic talking to you. How do people find out more about Forked Up? What's the best place to go and find out more about you?
Social, Instagram, Callum Richardson, with a number one. Facebook, Forked Up, and ForkedUpCoach.com.
ForkedUpCoach.com, excellent. Callum, thank you very much for your time. It's been awesome. I'll see you soon.